wonderful little story that Frank just read. And chapter 10 is just full of Proverbs. And so what we're going to do today is focus on that story in 9 and try to see how those Proverbs in the next chapter kind of even amplify the story in 9. But it's a little political. If you look in any commentary, any book on this section, it's a lot about leadership, a lot about kings and kingdoms, and we're not all politicians in here, I don't expect, right? But we cannot escape politics. No matter where you are, no matter where you work, no matter what friend group even you're in, there's politics. Politics is just it's when groups come together to make decisions, right? When groups come together to make decisions. And so that's going to be part of this today. So this is a fair warning, all right? Okay, big question of the day. Do we use God-given wisdom? We've been learning about it the whole way through, right? Wisdom in the face of time, wisdom in the face of death, wisdom in the face of the apparent randomness of life and all that is hevel. Are we willing to do what God says is best? The answer, though, is no. Right? Sometimes not, right? Sometimes we hurt ourselves. We hurt the other people around us with the things that we do, with our foolishness, with our anger, with our bad behavior. Right? We agree? That's sometimes us. And these mistakes don't erase our wisdom, but they do ruin it for a time. And in today's passage, we still have the teacher. He's been calling himself the teacher, the preacher. He's going to show us how just a little bit of folly or a little bit of idiocy will ruin the strength of wisdom, especially in politics. So here we go. It begins with a short story in 9, 13, and 14. It says, I've also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with a few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. So we are being set up, I don't know if you noticed this, but we're being set up for an expectation for this city to lose, right? Isn't that the feeling that we should get? Like, the contrast is painted there for us. We have this little city with a few men versus a great king and his great siege works. The expectation should be naturally the great is going to defeat the small. The odds are stacked up against them. The king likely has ladders and catapults and archers, and maybe it's like in the movies and they've lit the arrows on fire. They have battering rams, and when you're outside the walls, you have time, right? When you're inside the walls, you don't have time. You're going to run out of food. You're going to run out of water. You're going to run out of supplies, so you have time on the outside. It's great versus not great. But, verse 15, there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Okay. Just changed, it flipped on our expectations. We thought there was going to be a loss here, and now there's not. And the teacher says this is something, a wisdom or an event that he witnessed, he saw happen. A little city being defended by an old, does it say old? No, poor, wise man. I had old for some reason in my head. Not by might, not by miracle, just by wisdom. And this has likely happened more than once in human history, right? Something like this. So we don't know what specifically the teacher is referring to, what specific event. There's an event that was pretty close to it, but it was a woman in the Old Testament. There was a woman in a small city who was able, with her wisdom, to keep her city from being destroyed by convincing the leaders in the city to not hold a fugitive. But that's not what this is referring to. It's very clear it's a wise man, right? So I was thinking, the teacher has described himself as a mighty king of Israel. So, and he says he's observed this event. To that changes the context a little bit. Because which side of the event would have the king been on? The loss, right? And to me, I think that this helps our understanding a little bit. Maybe this wise king has been thwarted by a wise man in a small town. Because the old wise man wouldn't be the hero. He wouldn't be a hero to the people of Israel. He wouldn't be a hero to this king. He would be the annoying guy who wouldn't let Israel expand. Right? In fact, the teacher says no one remembered that poor man. He's not a hero. He's not celebrated. We know the event happened, but we do not celebrate him. He does not have a statue. It was annoying. This little Moabite, Jebusite, whatever city just would not budge because of this wisdom. That could be what's happening here. Could be. But it's not. We're not given the details. So what do we need to take from it? We need to take from it what it will give us. This man did not have finances. He did not have power. He just had wisdom. That's it. He had wisdom. So the point of the story, verse 19, wisdom gives strength to the wise. Remember back in chapter 7, the teacher said, wisdom gives strength to the wise more than 10 rulers that are in a city. So here the teacher explains in verse 16, I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. We would say today, brains are better than brawn, right? Wisdom is better than might, but it has a weak spot. Think about wisdom's weak spot. It's kryptonite. The wise man is not the governor of the city. He has all the answers, all of the details, the plan, but he has to convince somebody. And that's the weakness of wisdom, is that it isn't always listened to. He has to convince his party. He has to convince his group in their politic decision. He has to sway them. They have to listen, and then they have to follow through on it, or nothing happens. See, a mighty man, like a Samson, a David, they would just grab a weapon and go win the war by themselves, right? A wise man has to convince the people. So it's stronger than that one guy with the axe and the shield, but you have to convince the people. I know another poor wise man named Jesus that works pretty similarly, right? He has the words of life, and everything he says is true and best for us, and we often despise it and go, I don't trust that. And the wisdom of God is then weakened in our life when we don't follow. And wisdom's always quieter. It's the quietest voice in the room, because we've been told in this book that anger is foolishness, and anger is always the loudest voice. Teacher finishes his thought by saying this: the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. In the next chapter, in verse 4, he'll say, if the anger of a ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that we will likely, hopefully, not be besieged by a king in our city. In Jupiter, right? But we might have experienced being besieged in our offices, where our bosses and our leaders come against us, and when they do, keeping calm can be wisdom. Keeping calm. Earlier in Ecclesiastes, though, the teacher said, in a very similar situation, to depart from them. So what we have here is, situationally, wisdom can be departing from the angry person or remaining calm in the anger's presence, being dependent on God to know which is the right decision, right? But the one that is most natural to us, the thing that we is our go-to response, is neither of those things. It's usually just anger, right? Anger begets anger. You feel me? your boss rises up against you, some other person in another group, and you're just like, I'm angry back. I am so guilty of this. Anger comes out in different ways, though. Sometimes it's the actual outlash, like lash out. And you are just, you look like a fool. Everyone can see it. And then there's the other kind where it just boils inside. And you start immediately plotting how to overthrow this person. That's not wisdom. Staying calm in the presence or departing from the anger is wisdom. But let's say I just want to overthrow the boss. I want to overthrow the king in my little kingdom because he's so bad. That apparently isn't always wisdom either. In chapter 10, verse 5, he says this, "There is an evil I have seen under the sun. As it were, an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I've seen slaves on horses and princes walking around like on the ground like slaves." So the teacher has seen empires turned upside down by rebellion. And what happened was that the people who didn't know what they were doing ended up overthrowing those who did know what they were doing. And so maybe you've seen this. People being placed in leadership positions that they're not qualified for. And they just bumble through meetings, and they forget to complete simple tasks, and they embarrass the people they're meant to represent. And you're just like, oh my goodness, what is happening here? The teacher speaks of fools being placed on thrones. Just change for change's sake. Now, rich and slave here do not, I was talking to Mike before church today about this, rich and slave in this passage is more of an ancient stereotype than it is meant for us to think about actual rich people and actual slaves. It's stereotypically the rich were in power, they were educated, they were nobility, and the slave was uneducated and unskilled by situation. So that's really how we can read it here. I've adjusted it for today's vernacular. There is an evil I've seen under the sun, an error that can be blamed on whoever is responsible. Immaturity is set in many leadership positions, and the experienced and the qualified are out of office. I've seen uneducated and unskilled writing and style, while nobility have been put out to pasture. That's a great evil that the teacher has seen. So, look, 2019, we can totally see this in our actual United States politic deal. It is in vogue right now. You are well off if you have not been trained in government. If you are the outsider, people like you more than if you're the insider, right? So we'll watch this play out this year on the Democratic side, because they're the only ones really getting any, like having debates and stuff, right? They'll have a person who has a voting record as a governor or as a senator will get picked on for his record, while we'll celebrate someone who's never served. It's bizarre. But that's something that is not new under the sun, because it's very similar to what the teacher is saying he's seen here, where people will rush into jobs that they are not qualified for. You might have seen something like this in your own place of work. A person gets a promotion because a warm body's needed. Right? Someone leaves, someone resigns, you're like, oh my goodness, you are here. Now you have this role, right? It's happened, I've seen this, and you're available, and then time passes and you're still in that job and everyone kind of forgot about it, and you're still not qualified for it, and then you still don't know what you should do. Now, sometimes those situations unearth champions. I've seen that. Where someone unqualified gets in a position and they're just a superstar and you're just like, wow, this is amazing, right? But then we've also seen where they're just still a warm body. And you're like, what is happening? This is not good. And the teacher says this is an error that's attributed to the people who make it possible. So question, when this reversal happens, what should we expect? What type of leadership? And the answer is in chapter 10, 16, and 17. it's childlike leadership. And not in a good way. Not in like a Jesus come to me with faith as a child. This is like child, like man baby leader. Okay? In verse 16 he says, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness." It is a time to celebrate when our leaders know how to do their jobs. We might not agree with every single decision they make or dress code or whatever thing is happening, it's a time of happiness when we trust that they actually know what they are doing. And it is sad when we're afraid that our leaders are going to act like children, right? It's upsetting. It causes anxiety when instead of eating for strength and drinking for strength, they are just drunk with power and act like children. Now, don't get me wrong. There have been systematic leaders in our world that have need to be replaced. And there have been really manipulative, destructive, abusive bosses that need to be removed. But generally speaking here, wisdom is not enabling the uneducated, unskilled into positions that are being held by the trained and skilled adults in the room. So, the king in your life is being the worst. Can you picture it? Whether it's wisdom for you to run away, wisdom for you to stay calm, wisdom for you to, this is the one, this is the time to rebel. The teacher warns in 10:20, "Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature will tell the matter." Basically, watch what you say, because they're still the boss, right? Be wise and survive this situation. So the story the teacher is telling us, though, in 9 is about this poor wise man who's thwarting the efforts of the mighty king. His wisdom is greater than might. The wise man in the small city has something more powerful than cursing the king. He has something more powerful than instituting rebellion. My little village versus the kingdom. He has something stronger than weapons of war. He has the wisdom of God. The teacher says wisdom is better than weapons of war. And that's a powerful claim. But just like before, it has a weakness. It's vulnerable. And here's what the teacher says the vulnerability is. And this is unfortunate because it's gonna hit home with us. But one sinner destroys much good. That's the caveat to wisdom is more powerful than weapons of war, but one sinner ruins the whole thing. Remember, we had that contrast, the small and the few versus the great. Now we have the one versus the much, or the many. At the beginning of chapter 10, the teacher says, "Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a foul stench. And so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor." It would be kind of like us, we say like a rotten apple ruins the whole bushel. Or my favorite, a puddle of pickle juice on your plate will ruin all the fries. And I have a whole sermon based off of that illustration. We're not going there. But why? Why is wisdom so vulnerable? Because they are opposites. It's vulnerable to folly and foolishness and idiocy because they are opposites. In 10:2, it says, "A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but the fool's heart to the left." Now, the teacher's not thinking about Republicans and Democrats when he says the right and the left there. Otherwise, that would be the tagline verse of the Republicans, right? It would be. It'd be on bumper stickers. Wise man heart is to the right. Okay. For the teacher's original audience, ancient Far East, we have the right hand was the side of power and authority. So you'll see things in scripture like, I will uphold you with my right hand. You'll see right represent morality and represent the favor of God. And if you're placed seated on the right hand of the leader, it is the place of honor. Right is always wisdom and favor of God. When Jesus is talking about the final judgment and the sheep and goats, the sheep go to the right. The goats go to the left. So, wisdom is vulnerable to fools, and we can always see the fools coming a mile away. Sometimes it's us, and they can see us coming, and sometimes it's them. This is the language the teacher uses in chapter 10. Fools who dig pits and forget where they cover them fall into them. Yep, and we've seen that, right? Fools who knock down retention walls in their gardens without checking if there's snakes behind it get bitten by snakes. Yep. Fools who work in the stone quarries get crushed by boulders. Fools who lumberjack have trees fall on them. Fools who ignore roof maintenance have leaky roofs. This is all in the scripture in chapter 10. Foolish snake charmers get bit by snakes before they charm them. Fools get tired from being too ignorant to find their way home. And fools are consumed by their own foolish stories. We have seen these types of people. The idiot doesn't have to be the person in charge. Sometimes it's just someone on your team, in your group, in your family. Sometimes it's the girl who shoots every time she catches the ball and ruins the offense. Sometimes it's the teacher who never follows the state standards in the classroom. Sometimes it's the library worker who doesn't put the books back right. And those are just anecdotal stories from my family. Basketball, teaching, library, right? These are relatively small teams, though, and on those small teams, it's easy to identify the fool. But what if the entire nation is good, and there's just one fool in the nation? What happens then? Will one sinner destroy much good? The answer is yes. And I want to address this real fast. You guys remember the story of the Battle of Jericho, right? Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. So, two armies in a typical battle would face off. But that's not what happened at the story of Jericho, because Israel would have been so outmanned, they would have lost really, really bad at Jericho. So, God in his wisdom gives Israel an alternative plan. Walk around the city, play some music, and the walls will fall down. It probably didn't seem like wisdom, but they trusted that that was God's word and God's way. They trusted that was best, so that's what they did. And the walls fell down, and it was a huge celebration. But there's more to the story that gets left out in the Sunday school version. There was rules about what's to happen when the walls fall down. And one of the rules was, if anything was made out of silver, gold, or bronze, it was to be brought to the treasury of the nation of Israel, and if it was anything else, it should be destroyed. See, when the walls fall down, temptation would rise. There would be everybody's stuff. Right? There's gold and silver and precious stones and silk garments and fancy idols and fancy ox goads and torches and lanterns and wall decorations and so much. The Israelites would be like, I want, I want, I want, I want. But there was a rule put in by God that said, don't. If it's good, bring it to me. And if it's anything not at this level of good, just burn it. So the walls came down. And the nation of Israel, as far as everyone knew, was super faithful, and everybody did what was right, except one sinner did not. one dude named Achan, he took some treasure, he hid it for himself, he buried it under his house, his tent, because they didn't have the, they were traveling still. Nobody would be the wiser. It's just my stuff. But God knew. And so when it came to conquer the next city, which is either Ai or I, depending on which teacher you listen to, it was a super small city that Israel would be able to beat. They didn't even send their whole army. It was like, this is so easy. Let's send a few guys. We'll take out Ai. It's going to be totally fine. And they lost. And Joshua goes to God. And he's like, what in the world? Why did we lose to this city? And God's like, because the nation has sinned against me. Now, as far as anyone knew, the nation had not. But one sinner destroys much good. So through a really long process, Joshua is able to discover the one sinner is Achan. Achan confesses his sin, shows him where the treasure is. Treasure's placed in the treasury. And then Achan is killed. It's really not the last part of the story that you would really like. He confessed. He showed where it was. He put it in the right spot. And then he was executed. Without that guy amongst them, without the one sinner, they were able to conquer Ai with ease and many other cities of Canaan. It's really easy to see what to do when it's an Achan-like situation, when Achan's the fool. But what do we do when it's us, when we're Achan? What's God going to do when the one fool who destroys much good is me? Achan was killed, not from old age, from execution. Is God going to kill me? Would be the proper question from the story. The answer is no, and there's two things that we have to consider here. First, there are spiritual consequences for sinning against God, and then there are earthly consequences for sin as well. But they're not the same thing. Okay? There is a heavenly spiritual consequence for sin because it's rebellion against God and it must be dealt with. And there are always consequences for sin on an earthly level because we hurt each other and that affects our relationships. You know, when the girl who shoots nonstop on Delaney's team continues to do that, the teammates don't like her. There's relationship issues, right? When Jackson goes to straighten up the bookshelves at the local library and the person before him doesn't know the alphabet, that affects Jackson's relationship with that person, right? And those are just light consequences. We've had much more serious things. Achan was subject to death because that was the earthly law he was subject to. The earthly law that they established for the people of earth was that you do this or death. If you were at war now and you stole something from someone's house in Afghanistan, you likely wouldn't face execution, right? You're at war, you looted a house, same thing, different people, different times, different penalties. When Achan gets his earthly consequence, it is not his spiritual consequence. Nowhere in the text does it say that Joshua was sending Achan to eternity without God. But he did have to die because that was the earthly consequence right there. Do you see the difference? Achan might have been headed towards the resurrection of the dead with Jesus Christ. Earthly consequences are not spiritual consequences, and vice versa. So, you were the fool. You went against wisdom. You made everything a folly. You destroyed much. The whole team suffers. Is God going to kill you? No. But you may suffer relationally, earthly law penalty consequences. It'll depend on the situation. Well, what about spiritually? One of the most powerful things about Jesus Christ is that as the very embodiment of God, when he died on the cross, he took all of our sin upon himself by execution, and that was the final execution for sin against God. This, that becomes the option. We now have a choice. Do I want Jesus' death to work on my behalf so that my sin is paid for, or would I like to remain a holder of this debt and face judgment myself? Would I like it to already be paid for and the judgment and the execution be over, or would I like to just try to pay that myself? Now, admittedly, letting Jesus take that for you is an act of humility. But if we let Jesus take it, we'll never answer for it spiritually. Never. If we decide we would like to remain the holder of it, we will pay in full. I tell my students, judgment is always going to happen. It's either falling on Jesus or on you. Which sounds better? One of those is good news. So let's say I've chosen to let Jesus' death work on my behalf and he set me free from my sins and I'm an idiot again. I'm the one sinner who destroys much good again. What now? I would say, welcome to the team. You are welcome here. We have all done that. We find ourselves in this boat where we love God and we have this peace in our relationship with God and our debt is fully paid and it's never revoked and we mess up. We are not squashed spiritually from this and we should never fear that. But what is being said here, and we know this from experience, when we are not squashed spiritually, that does not protect you from being squashed earthly. But it's hevel. Everything here is vapor, smoke. And thus, in it, even in our folly, even in our mistakes, we should trust and follow God. The Apostle Paul said this in Ephesians 5. He says, be careful then how you walk, not as unwise people, but as wise, making the most use of the time because the days are evil. So do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Christianity is not Jesus saved me, so I'm off scot-free and I don't need to be good or wise or helpful to anybody. I'm fine. Ha ha, na na na, boo boo. Jesus saved me. It's, I can't be squashed here. I can totally be squashed here. And because of the love that God has given me, I want to walk worthy and wise and good in what the will of the Lord is. So, one time Jesus was asked, hey, what's the most important thing? What should I be doing? And Jesus said, love God and love everybody else. Love God, love everybody else. When we do this, we're wise. When we do that, we're obedient. When we do that, we cannot be foolish. A friend of mine once said this, faith is upward. It's believing I have everything I need because what Jesus has done for me. And then love is outward. It's the outworking of faith. Because Jesus has done everything for me, I can now do everything for you without needing anything from you. So you can be a fool to me. And I can still give you love. And then when I'm a fool to you, you can still give me love. Because we have everything we need. And oh man, if all we're going to have is conditional love and a den of fools, no one's going to love anybody. Paul wrote in Galatians 6:2, we are to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And that, bearing one another's burdens, is a call to action. It's not passive. Loving people passively, I love you, it's really easy to do. But to love actively is hard. It's messy. And when we love actively, it's not going to fit nicely in our groups. It doesn't fit in our friend groups. It doesn't fit in our political groups at work. It doesn't fit in our political groups of government. Love is for all, and it's messy. If we're committed to our group, over our commitment to God, we're going to miss out on loving large groups of people. Large groups of people. We're going to be moved to inaction. We'll be moved to blindness towards evil if we don't love everybody. Walking in wisdom in this time, in this place, 2019, is going to be messy. And our call is still love God, love others, no matter what they have done or do. Remember the poor wise man in the little city where this all started, right? He had great wisdom, but the weakness there was that he had to convince others of his wisdom. Can you imagine this man in 2019? Hey, leaders of this small city, I have a proposal on how we could save the city. Who is this man? Let's check Google. Wise old man, voting registration. Sorry, wrong party, dismissed. City Falls. Love and listening and obedience is just bigger than this. It's bigger than the politic. Jesus is for us all. Right? At this time, we like to turn our attention to the Lord's table, and we have this symbolic memorial of what Jesus has done for us. The cup and the bread that represent his blood and his body that was shed for us. We give thanks that he does not hold those things against us, and when we are crushed here on earth by the conditional love of this world, right? He holds on to us the whole way. We give thanks for his offer of mercy and grace, and anyone who shares in this faith in Jesus Christ is welcome to join with us as we partake. Let's pray. Jesus, you are so, so good to us. Every page that we turn in this scripture points to you in some way. You truly are the wise man who has these words that we easily despise, that we easily ignore, and they're right there for us to follow. Help us to be in your party, to listen and obey. God, show us how to love and how to receive love from others. We are all such great fools. We do not celebrate that, but we do acknowledge that you love us through that. Help us to walk as wise today, and thank you. In your name I pray.